What kind of mother would abandon her little girl to make someone else happy? There are places a child like her can be sent. It isn't cruel. What did that mean, a child like her? Was Iola handicapped, deformed? I hadn't noticed anything when I'd found her body, but back in the day, there were superstitions about problems like that. I'd seen a little girl on the news who'd been nearly starved to death in an African orphanage because a mutated gene had caused her to have mottled skin. A couple from New Jersey had adopted her and saved her life. Could something like that explain why Iola's mother would agree to send her away? Did she really believe it was best for Iola, or was it just convenient? A compromise made in order to keep a job, to maintain a life that was comfortable. Was her 10-year-old daughter the price she had to pay to please Monsieur and Madame? Would a mother sell her child for so little? My mother had given us up for less than money. For liquor, for parties, for one-night stands. For her constant need to feed on the chaos and drama of relationship upheaval. Anything that kept the momentum going. If life calmed and settled into a pattern like it had during those months on the Outer Banks, she eventually couldn't stand it. She'd conjured false accusations to ensure that Pap-Pap and Meemaw couldn't seek custody of us. She'd told horrible lies and made everyone believe them. Finding Iola's second letter, I set it atop the first one, slowly recreating the collection from the box. A timeline of a life that wasn't easy, at least in its beginnings. Yet Iola had ended up owning this beautiful house, having money, gorgeous things. Bracing a hand on the quilt, I looked around the room, took in the pastoral prints on the walls. Was that the kind of life Iola had ended up living? Did I really want to know? It hurt to read the words of the little girl who'd been sent away, who was alone and afraid that the people who were supposed to love her had instead forgotten about her. It dredged up too many memories, unearthed feelings I didn't want to remember. Scenes from my life that I've been trying to bury for 33 years. Pain that was pointless now. My parents were both gone, victims of self-destruction. A drop of moisture slid down my cheek, leaving a trail that was warm and itchy. I closed my eyes, wicked away the salt water with my thumb. This was stupid. I needed to put the letters back in the box and leave them alone. There was no point rambling around in Iola's life. Reading her thoughts was like dipping a ladle into the toxic waste of my life and pouring it all over myself. It burned as it oozed along fresh skin and old scars. What good could possibly come of walking through all that pain again? Swiping the moisture on my jeans, I reached for the stack of letters, slipping one hand on top and one hand underneath, preparing to lift the stack all at once, turn it over, and wiggle it back into the box. It was wrong to invade someone else's prayers. I shouldn't have been looking. These things weren't meant for human eyes. But why had she kept them? Why had she left them here, carefully stored and boxed all in order? Did she want someone to see, to understand? Did she want to leave behind a record of her life, of all the things she'd prayed for? Did she know someone was coming? Someone who would feel this girl's words in the deepest parts of her own soul? She couldn't have known, of course. There was no way Iola could have predicted that I would come here. She hadn't left the letters for me. The best thing would be to gather all the boxes, take them next door, and toss them into the church dumpster with the rest of the trash from the house. Surely Iola wouldn't want her private thoughts to end up being bargained off in some estate sale, possibly distributed all over the island. A freak show for those who were curious about her, who'd whispered behind their hands while she was playing the church organ. Those people didn't deserve to see what was inside these boxes, to have Viola's private life exposed for them to examine, to ridicule, to criticize. I could empty all the boxes, take the letters to the trash, and put the containers back on the shelves. No one would ever know the difference. When the house was cleaned out or auctioned off or torn down, whatever eventually happened, Iola's private life would remain private. It was the least I could do for her, considering that she'd sheltered us when we had nowhere to go. A final favor for a woman who took the time to think of the grocery delivery boy, even when she was struggling to save her house from rainwater pouring through the roof. Setting the stack of letters on the bed again, I rose so quickly that the cat sat up, arching his back, startled. "Good thing I bought trash bags yesterday," I said. "Wonder how many it'll take to empty all those boxes." I could start with the lower ones, but I'd still have to figure out how to get to the upper shelves. Maybe I could stack a couple chairs on top of each other. It might take three to reach the collapsed shelf near the attic hatch. Climbing that high on a tower of chairs didn't sound like the most brilliant plan. If I fell and broke a leg, The kids and I would be in worse shape than we were now. Where in the world could I get a ladder? If I asked Ross, he would want to know why I needed it. I'd have to admit that I was working in Iola's house. Knowing Ross, he'd tell the whole surf crowd. Word would get around, and people would be pushing me to let them see. And considering what the deputy had said, and Brother Gilbo's request that I keep things quiet, asking at the church didn't seem like a great idea either. I'd just have to start cleaning out the boxes at the bottom and figure out the rest later. Something would come to me. I'd always been good at finding a way to make do with what I had. Pap taught me that. He created the most beautiful things from scraps of wood he picked up here and there. Somewhere in the moves from foster home to foster home those last few years, I'd lost the little driftwood treasure chest he made when we were out on Hatteras. I'd helped him cut the wood and hollow out the space inside, not knowing that it was for me. I'd seen him make the boxes before and sell them at the roadside stand where Meemaw peddled vegetables and canned goods from their farm. Tourists loved the boxes as much as they loved Meemaw's blackberry jelly. While I was sleeping, Papap had created the little treasure chest, pressed shell hash, bits of mother-of-pearl, and chips of softly colored beach glass into the cracks and knotholes, then suspended it in place with clear lacquer so that his creation became a work of art, a piece of the ocean I could hold in the palm of my hand. He had given me the treasure box on the morning of my 13th birthday. Something made from nothing. Inside was a little piece of blue beach glass on a silver chain. A mermaid's tear, he called it, and patted me awkwardly on the shoulder as I slipped the chain over my neck. The mermaid's tear. I'd lost it along with the treasure box. But I hadn't lost the lessons I'd learned, scrambling around construction sites. I knew how to build things. If I had to, I'd gather up some scrap wood and make a ladder. For now, I'd take care of what I could reach. I hurried downstairs for trash bags. A sliver of guilt needled as I glanced past the piano room toward the long hall where the kitchen doorway loomed, the light in there bright and cheery, a slice of black and white tile and blue-rimmed china showing. So much work was waiting for me, and I wasn't making enough progress on it. I'd spent too much time messing around upstairs and running off with Ross. The trash bags I'd brought were still on the table in the entry hall, not a single one used to contain the refuse in the kitchen. Now I was headed upstairs again. What if Brother Gilbo stopped by to check on me? I'd just have to be quick. Before anyone else could find it, I was going to bury Iola's junk and my own, where it would never come up again. My footsteps echoed through the house as I grabbed the trash bags and ran back up the stairs, taking them two at a time. When I re-entered the blue room, the tomcat was lounging in the center of the bed, lying broadside over the letters, the stack now flattened and spread out. Get off of there. I pulled out a trash bag and shooed him with it. Those aren't yours to lay all over. Go away, shoo. He hissed and held his ground, his tongue curling behind sharp yellow teeth. Shoo. I batted at him with a pillow, and he arched like a tiny panther, moving to the corner of the bed and growling, the primal sound raising short hairs on my neck. You keep talking to me like that, and I won't feed you anymore. The show of bravado was as much for me as for the cat. I'm doing her a favor. She wouldn't want those people putting their hands all over this stuff, okay? It's private. You might not know that. Well, of course you don't. You're a cat. But I get it. I understand, believe me. He growled again, his gaze narrow, steady, and eerily bright. Monitoring him from the corner of my eye, I set the bag nearby and reached for the letters, raking them into a pile with both hands. You've probably got rabies. Or you've been in so many fights you're not all there, if you know what I mean. I would explain a few things about you. The cat didn't answer, which was a good thing. When he started talking back in full sentences, I'd know I'd been in this house too long. A sense of relief slid over me as I pressed the now disorganized batch of letters between my hands and tried to maneuver the trash bag with one elbow and one pinky finger. You wouldn't want to help open this, would you? Something slipped from the papers, snaked over my skin, cool and slick, then fell. It landed on Iola's single black shoe and slid to the floor, the sound a metallic tap, then a series of tiny taps. Tap, 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 tap. I leaned over, looked down. A small silver cross was lying on the floor, its surface dark with tarnish, a string of black glass beads slowly slipping from the toe of the shoe onto the floor. Tap, 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 tap. What in the world? Setting the letters atop the trash bag, I reached for the piece of jewelry, avoiding Iola's shoe, as if a single touch might somehow conjure up an unwanted ghost. A rosary? One so tiny it fit easily in the palm of my hand. It must have been tucked inside the paper, shaken loose when the cat scattered them around or when I scraped them back together. Turning it over in my hands, I studied the image, the outline of a man barely pressed into the thin metal. I ran my finger over it, felt the arms and legs. Tiny bump of the nails, the ribbon of the crown of thorns, the banner above the head. My fist closed around it, and I swiveled toward the closet, toward the boxes. Other things might be hiding among the letters, things that shouldn't be thrown away. No, I whispered, bringing my hand to my face, breathing the words over silver and tarnish and glass. All those boxes. Each would have to be checked, sorted, taken care of one by one. Okay, okay, I see. Disposing of a person's history wasn't so simple. Not as easy as gathering it up and packing it into bags. Valuable things hid among the scraps of a life. They could be anywhere. This job would take time, care. Whether I liked it or not, I'd been chosen to do the work. Lowering myself slowly to the edge of the bed, I reached for one of the letters, opened it, took in the uneven print, and turned my attention to the words, to the life of Iola Ann Poole. Nearby, the cat began to purr. Chapter 10. I was deep in the fourth box on the bottom row, the letters from 1936 painting a world I'd never known existed. Iola was 13, still living in the mission school in downtown New Orleans, where nuns cared for and educated children of color. That was Iola's crime, I'd figured out. She was a mixed-race child in a society that only wanted black and white. Iola was better off than many of the charges at the orphanage, however, as her board and education there were paid for, unlike those of the orphans found on the streets or dropped off by desperate families who couldn't feed them as the Depression raged on. Children with families to sponsor them received packages and letters in the mail, were given lessons in music and foreign languages, and were sent home to visit on holidays if their families could transport them. At 13, Iola had come to realize that her prayers of waking up to look like Aurelia, another girl at the school, would never be answered. She had adjusted to life with the nuns and the other children, but she still missed home, where her mother and grandmother managed a large house near the French Quarter for Monsieur, whose daughter Isabel had grown up alongside Iola. Iola went home once each year when Monsieur and Madame, Isabel's stepmother, were away vacationing in Charleston. Iola hadn't seen Isabel in the year she'd been at school, and she still missed her friend. In her prayer letters, Iola repeatedly pleaded with God to persuade Monsieur and Madame to allow her to come home, particularly when life was difficult in the school, when the other children were cruel or the nuns were harsh. I understood Iola's feelings, her yearning, her fear. Life with strangers isn't easy when you're just a child yourself. You can try your best to be good, to be perfect, to look at those people with eyes that say, love me, please. I need it. But love doesn't always come your way. Eventually, you learn to stop taking the risk. By the time I'd finally ended up with a foster family who really wanted me at 16, I couldn't open myself up to them the way they needed me to. The Lathrops were empty nesters with their daughter's show horses standing in the pasture, and they loved the fact that I was a good rider. They taught me everything I needed to know about riding show jumpers and helped me get a scholarship at a little college with an equestrian team. I repaid them by believing my freshman English professor when he told me I was special, talented, and that he'd never met anyone like me. I didn't even go home to the Lathrops again after I got pregnant. I knew how disappointed in me they would be. Instead, I tracked down my sister and moved in with her. Like most things with Gina, it didn't last very long. Reading Iola's letters, I wondered if she'd ever had the chance to go home again, or if she eventually traveled off into the world on her own, as I had. Iola enjoyed learning at the orphan school. Her writing had changed from uneven print to artful cursive, her thoughts slowly transforming from those of a child to those of an adolescent. The nuns had discovered that she was exceptionally bright, talented both in music and language. In the 4 years she'd been there, she had learned to speak proper French, begun instruction in Latin, and studied music. She'd been selected for a choral group that performed at various events around town, where ladies' societies and audiences at all-white churches were delighted with the angelic singing of colored children who had been lifted from their lowly stations by the compassion of nuns and generosity of benefactors. During her snatches of contact with the outside world, Iola had learned two things about herself. She revealed them through the final letter in the box, written just before Christmas 1936.
Hear them whispering, the ladies behind their hands. I catch bits and pieces as we file past after our singing. I see them watching me, craning beneath their broad-brim hats, fanning their sweating chins. Their voices buzz by my ear like the hum of a dragonfly, whirling along a riverside among the cattails.
At that one, how pale she is. No surprise that she'd been sent away. Someone's bastard. Will be quite a beauty. Wouldn't want her around my home either. Too much temptation there. And anathema, really. Anathema.
When we are back in school, I find Sister Marguerite so that I might ask her, what does this word mean?
Her baby leaf green eyes twinkle as she looks up from scrubbing the floors in the bathroom. She sings, even as she cleans the mess from too many children in so small a space. I ask, why does she sing when the work is hard?
All labor is joy, she tells me. It is not washing dirty floors, but the feet of Jesus, Iola. All we do for others, we do for the one most high.
I think of this for a moment. Is it possible that all service is worship?
I do not ask of this, but instead I ask about the word I have heard today. Anathema.
My, my, Ola Ann, but you do come to me with the most interesting questions, Sister Marguerite says. You've the intelligence of a girl much older than 13. Where did you hear that word?
At the Woman's Aid Society?
A lady looked at me and said it. I tell her. Sister Marguerite's smile fades. She pauses to turn my way, and moisture clings along the bottoms of her eyes, like dew in a trumpet vine.
It is a complicated word, she answers. Not one our Heavenly Father would be pleased to have us dignify with arts of conversation.
We are His children, each knit together we should be. We must go by the name our Father has given us, beloved. Not by the names which others might seek to place upon us.
She brushes a wrist across her cheeks, and she returns to her work. She sniffles softly.
I see that I have hurt her, and I should not ask about this again. I would never wound Sister Marguerite. She is kind to me.
I suppose it matters little, Father, as I heard Sister Agnes whisper yesterday when we filed out of court practice.
It's time we must replace Iola Ann. She's developing.
There was an emphasis on the final word. I felt her frowning at me, a wrinkled mouth like the navel of a Christmas orange. At first, I did not understand. I've learned so very much in the choral group. I've even begun to master the organ, not so different from Monsieur's piano. I strained to hear the whisper, and Sister Agnes went on with her thought. The audiences prefer children who are young, too young to be out working for themselves. It pleases them to feel as though they're donating to the helpless. Keeping urchins off the street, you know.
Certainly, said Sister Mary Constantine. It is a shame, though. Iola Ann has such a beautiful voice.
Sister Mary Constantine is pleased that she chose me for the choral group, and I have done very well. Just yesterday she promised a new hymn for me to sing, a difficult one.
I will not be learning the new hymn now, Father. I know it. I wonder, what will they do with me instead?
Were I an orphan, they would be looking to place me in a cotton mill or a tobacco house, but of course I am still here because Monsieur has paid my keep. I wonder, will I be here forever?
I pray that soon you will bring me home to Mama T and Mama and Isabel, Father. I pray that you will ever remind me to only answer to the name you have given me, not to the words men may offer. I am your child. My father has named me. I am beloved. Your daughter, Iola Ann.
A sound broke the silence. Something ringing, an alarm clock, maybe? It faded, then came again. A hot, sharp lightning of panic rushed through me. The doorbell. I scrambled off the bed, bouncing the mattress and causing the cat to jump to the ground and run for cover. Oh, no. Oh, shoot, shoot, shoot! I froze with my hands in the air over the quilt. If that was Brother Gilbeau or someone from the church, I was dead. I had stuff strung everywhere, and I wasn't even supposed to be up here. Anyone seeing the kitchen would think I was either lazy or a complete liar. I'd said I could handle the job no problem. Instead, I'd allowed myself to be sidetracked over and over.
Or what if it was the sheriff's deputies, back to investigate something?
If I opened the door, they would bulldoze their way past me like they owned the place. They'd paw through everything and find the letters. Think, think, think. Think, Tandy. Think of something. The contents of three boxes lay scattered in unkempt piles on the bed. I hadn't even been trying to fold the letters or prepare to fit them back in the boxes. I hadn't put one box away before getting out another. I'd just grab one letter and then the next, one box after another, reading hurriedly, hungrily, anxious to discover Isla's story, to learn how life had brought her from an orphanage in New Orleans to here. Okay, be calm. Be calm. I could finesse my way out of this, somehow. Moving to the window, I took a peek at the driveway. But if a car was out there, it had been pulled through and parked near the old garage building. Between the thick growth of trees and the porch roof, I couldn't see a thing. Passing glance in the dresser mirror confirmed that on top of everything else, I was a wreck. My hair hung in a frizzball ponytail, my eyes were red and puffy, and my cheeks were streaked with dried tear trails. I'd been through a meat grinder of emotions this morning, and it showed. I promised myself I would only stay here with the boxes a few more minutes, but instead I'd been here for hours. My heart pounded as I smoothed back my hair, slapped and pinched my cheeks, then hurried to the stairs. The old rotary bell clanged again, the visitor thumbing the trigger, then letting it free. Once, twice, a third time. Whoever it was had no intention of going away. "Hang on," I called from the mid-landing, then winced as the treads popped and creaked underfoot, the noise ridiculously loud. What if the visitor heard it and knew I'd been upstairs? A story began spinning, part fact, part invention. The cat, I heard the cat up there, and then the water running. It's all taken care of now, though, nothing to worry about. No reason to go up there. The faucets are old, and they must have slipped on a little. I tied the handles closed so it wouldn't happen again. The tapestry wove itself, threads intertwining with impressive speed. Behind the veiled glass sidelights in the entry, a human outline shifted back, then forward, disappearing as the visitor reached for the bell, then reappearing. Someone tall, a man, dark clothes, too thin to be Brother Gilboa. Wrong kind of hat for a sheriff's deputy. This guy had on a ball cap. I reached for the knob, flipped the ornate-looking brass slider that secured the lock from the inside, pulled the door open. A UPS man. The man in brown. Middle-aged, friendly-looking, clean-cut, with a gray, dusted mustache. He had a box under one arm and a plastic grocery bag dangling from the other. We stood staring at each other for a moment while I caught my breath, thinking, "Seriously? All that panic for a UPS delivery? Phew, thank God." He blinked. "Where's Miss Isla Ann?" He lifted the grocery bag in an unconscious way that told me it was for her. The outline of a flour sack, two cans, and several bananas showed through the thin layer of plastic. "I brought her something." It dawned on me that I was about to be the bearer of bad news. "She passed away a little over a week ago. I'm sorry, I guess you didn't know." I stepped out and peeked around the corner of the house. He'd pulled his truck in by the old garage. He probably knew from experience just where to stop so that he could back up and turn around without hitting trees or the weathered concrete hitching posts with the Iron Mermaid finials. "Old Mrs. Poole." He let his head fall forward, looking crestfallen. The dry river of a sweat stain drew a faint, uneven line around the rim of his hat. I focused on it a moment, thinking that it probably wasn't easy schlepping packages in the thick summer humidity here. "I'm gonna miss her. She was one of my favorite stops." I felt a surprising backwash of grief. It seemed strangely sad that I was trying to understand Isla now, after my chance to meet her was gone. "Did you know her well?" I shouldn't have asked, I guess. The question made it obvious that I was a stranger here. "She was one of my good nannies." "Your what?" Lifting the grocery sack again, he gave me a sheepish look. "Guten nannies. That's German for sweet little ladies who can really cook. I'd bring a few supplies by here if the grocery store was clearing out overripe fruit, and when I'd come back this way for a delivery in a day or two, she'd have beignets or cookies in the freezer waiting for me. Put Iola's banana beignets on the dashboard, let them warm up in the sun a couple hours, and His eyes closed, and he shook his head back and forth, as if he could taste them now. "That's nice. So Isla hadn't been the hermit that everyone thought. She was friends with the UPS man. I guess she got delivers quite a bit then. What could she possibly have been receiving, and where did she put it? The downstairs was cluttered with boxes and belongings, but most of it seemed to be old stuff.
Yeah, fairly often.
The wrinkles deepened around his eyes, and I had the sense that there was something he wasn't telling me.
Especially since she quit driving a couple years ago. The first year I was on this route, she had a little red Dodge Dart she ran around town in. It was vintage, was slick as a whistle. She must have been in her late 80s by then. That one week I came, and the Dart was gone. She'd backed into a post by Burke's Market down in Hatteras Village, and she got rid of the car the next day. Said she was afraid she'd have an accident and hurt somebody.
I nodded along, indicating neither that I knew the story nor that I didn't. But it sounded like the Iola I'd begun to know from the letters upstairs.
I felt sorry for her after that.
Setting the box down for a minute, he whisked the cap off his head and wiped his brow with a tan hanky, then stuffed it back into his pocket. I hadn't seen a man carry a hanky in years.
She was lonely. I kept my number right there on her refrigerator. I'd pick things up in town for her if she needed them. I'll miss that high, squeaky voice coming up from my cell phone. Mr. Mullins, I do so hate to trouble you at home, but if it ain't too much bother, when you're out in your truck... She never could quite grasp the fact that the cell phone was traveling with me in the truck. She always thought she was calling me at home. I guess when you've been around since the days of steam trains and milk wagons, some things just don't seem possible.
Guess not. I couldn't help thinking about all the evolutions Iola had seen in her life. The changes in the world, the events, the cultural shifts. Dictators, wars, men on the moon. She'd been born in a different universe than this one. Her grandmother was a slave. My mind couldn't quite grasp that. Were all those things recorded in the boxes upstairs, her thoughts about the world carefully chronicled in prayer? I wanted to know her, to understand her, to solve the mystery of her. I felt the blue room tugging at me again, but I wasn't going up there, other than to put away the mess I'd made. Not today. I'd lucked out when this visitor was only a delivery driver, but I couldn't make that mistake again. I needed this job. The UPS man glanced at his watch and thumbed over his shoulder.
Mailbox is stuffed full outside. It's hanging open a little. I can run and grab it for you, if you want. I used to do that for Miss Iola Ann from time to time, especially this last year or so. She got to where she didn't come out of the house much. I think it was hard for her to make it down the porch steps.
He indicated the 8 wooden steps that led to the front walk. I squinted at them.
Iola didn't seem to have any problem climbing the stairs in the house. She was capable of hauling drip buckets back and forth to the bathroom. She could have made it down those outside steps if she'd wanted to.
There was a reason she had kept herself locked away here.
Maybe it was just that she was afraid she'd be taken to a rest home.
Maybe there was something more. Her boxes might tell me. No, that's all right. I'll pick up the mail.
The driver nodded, then handed over a package the size of 4 shoeboxes put together. Surprised by its weight, I shifted it to my hip, and both of us hovered there on Iola's porch, not seeming to know what to say.
"Someone probably ought to open that up," he suggested finally. "Usually, when she bought stuff, she had it billed to her. She didn't believe in credit cards, she told me that once. She had accounts with shops all up and down the outer banks. A couple times she gave me cash, and I dropped off payments for her, but mostly she paid through the mail, I think. Anyway, there's probably a bill in that package. Whoever's looking after her affairs might want to take care of it. The stores on the island are operating on a shoestring since last hurricane. What stores made it through, that is.
Sure, I'll see that it's taken care of.
You a family member?
No, just a friend. I did feel like one at this point, a friend.
Clicking his tongue, he surveyed the Confederate jasmine and climbing roses pressing through the railings, ripe with determined growth of a new spring. She was a pretty lady. Even at 90 years old, had the brightest silvery-colored eyes. One time when I came, she brought out an old black-and-white photo. She told me she'd been sorting through some things, and came across it. I'll never forget her handing that thing to me and saying, "I was a looker, wasn't I?" And she was. That was quite a picture. She was posed like Jane Russell in the hay, and there was a big old Palomino horse nibbling on her ear. She looked like a pinup girl. I gave it back to her and said, "Miss Iola, you're still a looker." She laughed and told me if she was 40 years younger, I'd have to watch out. She was something else. I think she had stories she never shared with anyone. There was a lot that folks around here didn't know about her.
I set the package by my feet and leaned against the doorframe.
Did she ever tell you where she came from? How she ended up here in this house, I mean? He shook his head.
No, she didn't. Every once in a while, she'd mention something, a certain kind of car she had at one time or another, or someplace she'd been, but that was about it. She always wanted to make sure she wasn't holding me up for my work. That's the way she was. She thought about other people first, just like getting rid of that car. She didn't want to hurt anybody with it. She...
He stopped, reconsidered whatever he was about to say, then changed the subject.
I'll sure miss Iola Ann and those banana beignets. Melt in your mouth like little bits of heaven.
He extended the grocery sack my way as if he'd suddenly remembered he was holding it.
Here, do something with this stuff, okay? I don't want to look at it today.
Okay. I understood, really. After he was gone, I scooted the box farther into the vestibule so I could close the door. Then I peeked into the grocery sack, letting the scent of overripe bananas waft out. There was an old metal recipe box on Iola's counter. Maybe I would see if the recipe for banana beignets was inside. I'd never been much of a cook, but I'd watched Meemaw make beignets years ago, helped her squeeze the dough through the cut-off corner of a plastic bag into hot oil. I could cook them while I was cleaning in Iola's kitchen. Maybe I would. It couldn't be that hard. When the kids came home, I'd have something special waiting in the cottage, something homemade, smelling of cooking and love. We could sit down and eat the sweets, laugh, and lick the powdered sugar off our fingers. Zoe and I could talk without yelling, the three of us acting like a family for once. I could freeze a batch for the UPS man, call him and let him know to stop by when he had a chance. I had a surprise for him. A last little gift from Iola. I turned toward the kitchen before I remembered the package. I'd promised the driver I would make sure the bill was taken care of. Aside from that, I was curious about what was inside. The keys in my pocket worked well enough to slip the tape, and I folded back the thick cardboard flaps, revealing layers of soft white tissue paper with glitter infused. Underneath, the box was divided into a beehive of small cardboard cells, 2 dozen in all, and in each one, something strangely familiar. Tiny wings of colored glass, soft twist of ribbon, a gold ring, brass bells. I slid my fingers into one of the cells, pinched the tip of a wing, wiggled the tiny hummingbird into my hand. Cupped in my palm, it was surprisingly heavy. A body made of molded metal, the wings and the passion vine formed from delicate stained glass. "What did she plan to do with you?" I whispered, holding the bird up and looking at it eye to eye. Who needs 2 dozen suncatchers? The paper price tag twisted back and forth on a string, a flash of gold alternating with white. $45 times 2 dozen suncatchers. Over $1,000 worth of stained glass doodads. I caught the tag with my fingers, turned it over so that I could read the gold label on the other side, but I didn't need to. I knew what it would say. Sandy Seashell Shop, an ocean of possibilities. Chapter 11. I dawdled in the field of salt meadow hay, watching a pair of river otters frolic in a slough lined with sawgrass and spike rushes. In the parking lot at Banks, the cab of Paul Chastain's truck was empty. I was hoping to catch him as he came out, to just happen to be passing by with the ladder problem in mind, and happen to see him there, and happen to ask if I could borrow one of the ladders that I'd seen in his pickup the day he came to mow. I looked down at the bundle in my hand. The beignets, still warm, had soaked through and made 3 round grease stains on the napkin I'd wrapped them in. Bringing them was a stupid idea. They were a dead giveaway that I wasn't strolling by Binks at random. But it also seemed like, given the ugly parking lot scene with Ross, some sort of apology was due. Paul was a nice guy, and he didn't deserve to have Ross giving him the stiff arm just for talking to me about JT and Turtle Camp. The front door opened at Binks, and the bright colors of a Hawaiian shirt caught the sunlight beneath the overhanging porch. I hurried on to the parking lot as Paul exited the store backward, still talking to someone inside. When he turned around, there I was, passing by his truck.
"Well, hey,"
he said, his lips spreading into a smile as he came closer. He had something pinned between his teeth, the stick from a sucker, and he was talking around it, a bulge in his cheek. If he thought less of me after our last meeting in the parking lot, it didn't show. "Hey." I was smiling back before I knew it. Something about a grown man not ashamed to carry on a conversation with a sucker wadded in his cheek was funny. "How's the crab, honey?" There were buckets in the back of his pickup again, at least a dozen this time. Are you planning on feeding an army, or just doing science experiments on a larger scale? I pointed to his cargo. He shook his head.
Working today.
Setting his drink on the tailgate, he tipped one of the white plastic pails so I could see into it. There were clugs of grass inside. Weeding gardens? I took a guess. He didn't look like he was dressed for garden work. Today he had on a pink and green shirt with frogs on it, camp shorts that might have been camo-colored once, but were bleached to pale tones of cream and peach, and heavy rubber hiking boots. His freckled legs were sunburned in streaks where he'd apparently missed with the sunblock, and a foldable camp-style shovel hung over his shoulder on a nylon strap. All in all, he looked like a cross between a mountain climber and a Captain Kangaroo character.
Stabilizing frontal dunes and valuable boundary areas.
He cleared his throat and deepened his tone to give the words an exaggerated importance.
The Park Service doesn't pay me to crab hunt.
Oh, I see. I pressed a hand to my chest, pretending to rethink my earlier question. I remembered now. He'd said he worked part-time for the Park Service. Shrugging, he lifted his palms into the air.
If a crab trap or a fishing line happens to fall into the water while I'm in the performance of my duty, well, I can't exactly help that now, can I?
One of the buckets rattled, and he cast a wry, one-sided smile my way, a little twinkle in his caramel brown eyes. Well, I suppose not. I stood on tiptoe, and he reached for the bucket to show me. I guess you keep the crab traps and fishing lines all baited, just in case one slips into the water accidentally.
They work better with bait on them.
I peeked into the bucket. Crawdads. Looks like there's a problem with crawdads, saying slipping out of the truck too, huh? I knew all about sand and crawdads. We lived on a canal in East Texas once. I remembered walking along the bank with Daddy, helping to pull the seine, knitting up dinner. Paul lifted his hands, palms up, his shoulders rising.
Darnest thing, really. What slips out usually depends on where you're working. I was over in the Tidewater today, just down from a crawfish farm, and those seines get rowdy when there's a mud bug hole nearby. When a net wiggles off into the water, what can you do but pull it back out? Learned that from my dad. He was a county sheriff down in Alabama, so he rambled around in the backwoods a lot.
I take it there were also a few fishing poles and a crawdad seine or two in the back of the sheriff's car? I caught a whiff of banana beignets and noticed that Paul was giving the napkin a curious look.
I do come by it honestly,
he admitted.
You know what they say about the seines of the father.
He blinked slowly, holding back his lopsided Tootsie Pop smile, waiting for the pun to work.
Oh, that was bad.
The joke pulled a groan from me, but I found myself thinking about Paul's father, wondering what kind of man he was and trying to imagine him. Was he redheaded and fair-skinned like Paul? I pictured him a little like Andy Griffith, with a little boy Paul in the Opie role. I had the strangest urge to ask Paul about it, to sift out a scene of boy and man walking down the levee in the summer grass. Instead, I somewhat awkwardly handed over the napkin with the beignets.
Oh,
Paul appraised appreciatively as he unfolded the napkin and examined the sugar-dusted contents.
These look a whole lot better than crawdads. Can we work a trade?
I wanted to thank you for being so good to JT, and I have a favor to ask.
Okay, shoot,
he replied, as in, whatever it is, I'm there. But he didn't look at me. He was busy comparing the beignets and deciding which one to eat first. I wondered if he'd forgotten that he had a lollipop in his mouth. The thought seemed to occur to him at the last minute, and he quickly extricated the Tootsie Pop, then dropped it into one of the buckets. I got around to my original reason for being there. I was wondering if I could borrow that tall ladder you had in your truck the other day. He gave me a curious look, and I quickly added, "There isn't anything like that around the cottage, and I need one for a day or two."
Don't imagine Iola did much ladder climbing at her age.
He sampled one of the beignets, closing his eyes and smiling as he chewed.
Oh, man, these are heaven. I've had some good beignets, but these are top-notch. What's in there, bananas?
I nodded, an unexpectedly light, airy sensation fluttering through my chest. I couldn't remember the last time I'd cooked anything that wasn't from a box, but it felt good to take the supplies from the UPS driver and create something warm and fresh. Sort of a new beginning from an old ending. A rebirth. I had a feeling Iola would have liked that. Maybe she was rubbing off on me a little. Iola and Sister Marguerite. It felt good to do something good for someone else, to add a few deep-fried droplets of kindness to the world. A little act of service. Is it possible that all service is worship? The words were still in my head. It was Iola's recipe. I slanted a glance toward the store, thinking of the last time I'd been in there, the way Bink had sneered and crossed his arms when Iola's name was mentioned. How could anyone dislike the sweet little woman who made beignets for the UPS driver?
I thought I'd heard she was from down in New Orleans, so I guess it makes sense, beignets,
Paul mused.
When I passed through the church office a few days after she died, they were talking about her final arrangements. That was how I knew she'd left the house to the church, and what gave me the idea of dropping over to do the mowing.
Is that where she was buried? New Orleans? It bothered me that I didn't know, that I still hadn't heard a thing about her funeral. It seemed like she deserved something more than to just disappear.
Yeah, I think so. Brother Gilbo said she wanted to be buried in some kind of family plot.
Oh. A sense of loss struck me suddenly. And the scent of beignets, beech grass, and crawfish turned cloying. I had the urge to tell Paul about the closet, the boxes, the shelf dangling 14 feet in the air. By my count, the glass box teetering on the broken shelf had probably been placed there just last year, by a woman in her 90s with no ladder. I backed away instead of sharing the story. Anyway, a ladder loan would be great. Paul pinched a beignet between two fingers, held it up, and admired it from all angles.
Sure. I'll stick the ladder in the back of the truck tonight, then drop it by tomorrow after I'm done at the school. I only have classes through the morning, helping to fill in for a teacher who's taking care of a sister with cancer. Anyway, ladder deliveries are no problem. Is noon soon enough? Otherwise, I'll run it by in the morning.
He toasted me with the beignet, then popped it into his mouth. Smiling, he murmured,
"Mm-mm."
My blue mood lifted like a cloud rolling off screen in fast-motion video. I'll bet your mama loves you. I imagined a dinner table scene. The happy mom, the friendly fishing dad, and red-headed Paul, all gathered around a big platter of crawfish, rice, and garden-fresh vegetables. A little dog sitting patiently on the floor, waiting for someone to toss a crumb his way.
Yes, she does.
He nodded, then popped the last beignet into his mouth and noisily licked his fingers. His mama hadn't emphasized manners. He seemed like the type who would have grown up with brothers. A family filled with men, where table manners and fashion choices meant nothing. He was giving me a curious look now, probably wondering what I was thinking. Well, okay, thanks. Noon's fine for the latter. I appreciate the loan. If I'm not there when you come by tomorrow, could you just leave it on the porch? I needed to keep the schedule loose in case Ross called, and I also had the box of suncatchers to return to Sandy's seashell shop. If Iola's estate ended up suspended in some kind of legal battle, they might never get paid for that box.
Sure, no problem. You mean the porch of the main house or the bungalow?
There was that funny word again, bungalow. And why had he mentioned the main house? Did he know I was working there? Maybe Brother Gilbo had told him. The school bus whirled around the corner, then stopped at the edge of Bink's parking lot and let off kids. JT wasn't among them, and neither was Zoe. I hope that meant they'd ridden home with Rowdy, but still, we needed to talk about the two of them running all over the place without letting me know. That talk probably wouldn't go well even with the beignets, but last night, thinking even for a few hours that I might never see my kids again had awakened me from the sleep of my own life. Something had to change between Zoe, JT, and me. The more time I spent with Iola's boxes, the more I could see what a mess we were. I answered Paul's question, then said goodbye and hurried off across the salt meadow to get home before the kids made it there with Rowdy. With any luck, I'd still have time to lock Iola's house, bring the beignets over to the cottage, and set us up for an afternoon snack and a family conversation, instead of a shouting match. But when I reached the cottage, Zoe was on her way out the door with her backpack over her shoulder and a towel under one arm. She had on short shorts and a flowered tank top I'd never seen before. She was all legs and curves. At a glance, she could have been 18 instead of 14. I recognized the M.O. of a little girl trying to look way older on the outside than she was on the inside. When I was Zoe's age, I'd figured out that the right clothes could get you all kinds of attention, and I liked it. It felt good to know that someone could desire me, want to be with me, want me. Zoe gave me a deer-in-the-headlights look, and then her eyes turned hard, icy. Rowdy was sitting in his Jeep out front, his head bobbing to music amps so loud that the bass was creating a minor earthquake. "I've got to go." Zoe made a preemptive strike, telling, not asking. "Wait, hold on a minute." Several quick steps brought me to the bottom of the porch stairs, blocking her exit path, unless she wanted to hop over the railing, which she looked like she might. What? A flash of lashes and a quick tilt of the head. Her hips jutted to one side. I knew the posture. Right now, Zoe looked too much like Gina. My big sister could give attitude like nobody I'd ever known. No matter how wrong she was right. Zoe huffed and jerked her chin toward the house. The dork's inside. I brought him home, okay? I made sure he's all safe in there, since it's not like you're ever here to... Stop calling him that. What was wrong with her lately? She'd been the little mommy since JT was born. He adored her. Always had. And all I did was walk over to Binks for a minute. I've been here all day, waiting for you to come home so we can talk. Whatever. Zoe fingered the thick silver chain holding an oversized class ring suspended over way too much cleavage. When had my little girl gotten cleavage? When had she become so comfortable showing it? I figured she'd be gone with Ross again. Suddenly, I was on the defensive. Yesterday wasn't Ross's fault, Zoe. Of course not. Nothing's ever his fault. She rolled her head to the other side, hair skimming over a bare shoulder and a silky curtain. But don't worry about it, okay? We're fine on our own. We're always fine. She blinked hard, her dark lashes matted with moisture. The word sliced through all the soft places, and I saw my sister again, saying the cruelest things, knowing right where to aim to cause the most pain. What, like those clothes? I swept a hand in the air between us, indicating the new outfit. You know what those clothes say, Zoe? Did he buy those for you? Rowdy must have bought the clothes. Zoe didn't have any money. Like mother, like daughter. She trotted down the steps and shoved past me, striding toward the car. Zoe, get back here! I hollered, but she just circled the Jeep, slipped in, and closed the door hard. Rowdy stretched a hand across the seat and strung his fingers into her hair. He didn't even turn the vehicle around, but backed all the way to the street at high speed, like he was afraid I'd jump in their exit path. I could imagine the things Zoe had told him about me. He probably thought he was saving her from the claws of a she-devil. Frustration drove me back and forth across the porch, furious, sad, helpless. I wanted to tie Zoe to a kitchen chair, lock her in her room, force her to listen. She was better than this. Somehow I had to find a way to show her, to make her see, like Sister Marguerite had with Iola, that she was beautiful, that she was worthy. Standing here with Iola's prayer boxes so close, I wanted to be better than I was. I wanted to stop running blindly down all the same paths. The thought nipped and bit, hungry and angry, painful and unnerving. I didn't know how to be anything except what I had always been. The car pulled in soon after Rowdy's Jeep squealed away. I gathered my wits and walked down the steps, meeting the vehicle as the driver turned off the engine and opened his door. He was middle-aged, balding on top, dressed in black pants and a white jacket with some sort of emblem on it. His round-cheeked face made him seem likable enough, but a ripple of concern inched upward inside me. Can I help you?
I just came by to look the property over.
He grabbed a clipboard off the dash. Oh, are you from the church? Thank goodness I'd put the prayer boxes away after the UPS driver had surprised me. The embroidered lapel on the man's jacket was from an investment company. He tucked the clipboard under one arm and twirled a pen from finger to finger like a tiny baton, then pointed it at the cottage.
You staying in the rental?
Yes. Up close, he didn't seem so nice. It was an old horse trader's trick, not giving a direct answer to a question, and right now he wasn't really looking at me, but through me, like I was getting in the way of his agenda, whatever it was. I thumbed over my shoulder toward Fairhope Fellowship. You might want to go by the church, because Brother Gilbeau...
Just taking a gander at the place for the county commission.
He cut me off, nodding along with his own words as if he wanted to make sure I swallowed them whole.
Looks like the hurricane damage was never fixed. Imagine the place is a health hazard by now. Water through the roof, mold all over the place, no doubt. Terrible to lose a historic home like this one, but it's obviously listing toward the west. Too bad the owner didn't keep it up properly over the years. Shame when these aging houses had to be torn down. Do you have a lease on the rental? And for how long, if I might ask?
Torn down? What? I was possessed with a sudden, fierce defensiveness of Iola and her home. Who was this man? He had some nerve standing here talking like that when the woman was barely in the ground. I was no expert in social niceties, but I'd been on the receiving end of a down-the-nose look too many times not to recognize one. Her name was Iola, I wanted to yell. Iola Ann Poole. She went to sleep in the blue room and never woke up. Instead, I said, but I thought I was supposed to clean.
You have a key to the main house?
He started toward it as if he was accustomed to people following at his heel. I recognized the drill. Trammell treated people this way. I like this guy less by the minute. No, I don't. And I have somewhere I need to be, actually. I'm sorry. Maybe Brother Gilbeau can help you. His office is next door. I pointed to the church again. The man swiveled at the waist and peered over his glasses. I have to go. I'm sorry. I hoped I wasn't making a mistake, but something told me to stay as far away from this guy as possible. Without waiting for an answer, I rushed back to the porch and stepped inside. I nearly collided with JT, who was clearly on his way out. Like Zoe, he stopped stock still, blinking as if he'd been caught. Where are you going?
No place.
A guilty look. To Banks, so you can hang around, maybe? He shrugged, the answer clear enough.
JT, listen, I know you like it there, but we don't need everyone in our business right now, okay?
In view of our latest visitor, that was doubly true. If that man knew we didn't have a lease and were overdue on the rent, I had a feeling we'd be out quicker than you could say, pack your suitcase.
We just, the three of us have to stick together. We don't want people checking up on us, understand?
But can I still go carry out their trash?
His enormous blue eyes pleaded for me to say yes, to let him continue his trips to Banks. I rested a hand on his head. What are you doing with all those leftover donuts? He squirmed under my fingers, looked down at his feet, and kicked a rock across the porch.
I'm taking to school.
Why? Zoe had been packing PB&J sandwiches for lunch each morning because that was all we had around. They could get water free at school. It was hard to believe things had come to this, but they had. Slipping his hands into his pockets, he shook his head.
Why, JT?
'Cause.
Because why?
Because then we don't use all the bread and we don't have to pay for more.
His eyes rolled upward under a knot of blonde brows, watching for my reaction. I felt sick. I'd been fussing at the kids about every bit of wasted food since we'd come here, especially early on when I was still getting off the pills and wondering if I'd make it through. Now my little boy was surviving on stale donuts, so I wouldn't have to feed him. Well, there's plenty of food now. I swallowed the tears. How in the world had we ended up here? I was better than this, smarter than this. How many times had I promised myself that I would never be like my mother and Gina? I'd be the one who held down a job, made a living, didn't take charity from anyone, made a life instead of just an existence. But this wasn't a life. This was desperation. We could be kicked out of the cottage tomorrow, end up on the street. Maybe the church didn't really own this place after all. Maybe it really was about to be torn down. If Ross changed his mind about taking us in, we could end up sleeping in the SUV. And there wouldn't be a thing I could do about it. I had to find a job. A real job. Something better than just cleaning out Iola's house. And I had to do it now. Chapter 12.
In the morning, I was on the porch of the Hatteras Village Library, waiting in the lingering morning mist when the librarian opened the door. 3 minutes later, I was on a computer, poring over web listings, looking for any place new that might take a chance on hiring someone with no references.
I couldn't exactly put Trammell's name down as my last employer. And over the internet, it was hard to successfully deploy the story that I was a recently divorced stay-at-home mom just re-entering the workforce. Growing up, I'd learned that the more you stick to one story, the easier it is. Gina never figured that out. When things were bad at home, she invented one wild tale after another, letting out so many lines that she eventually hung herself in them. I was finished on the library computer and heading for the door before I really wanted to be. There wasn't anywhere else to apply. Stopping by the front alcove, I considered my next move. If a job didn't magically come through soon, I'd have to leave Iola's place and Hatteras Island behind. The idea hollowed me out in a way I wasn't prepared for. I felt like I'd failed, like there was something I was supposed to unearth here, something I was meant to find in that big house, but I hadn't been looking in all the right places.
The builders position that so it points true.
The librarian motioned to a compass rose built into the tile floor of the alcove.
Follow the north arrow, and you'll be heading due north.
She gave the tile work a fond look as she moved past me with a bottle of Windex and a rag in hand. I studied the compass rose for a minute, waiting for the librarian to clean the glass door. If only true north were so easy to find in real life. I needed someone to show me which way to go, what to do now. The librarian must have read the desperation on my face.
Can I help you with anything else?
She offered a kind, accommodating look. I took the opportunity to ask for directions to Sandy's seashell shop. Nothing was too hard to find in Hatteras Village, but I couldn't afford to waste gas wandering around, and I hadn't noticed the store during previous trips down the island with Ross. I wanted to drop off the box of hummingbirds while I was here. If Sandy's seashell shop's financials looked anything like mine, they'd probably appreciate it. The librarian pointed out the door.
Just keep on going around the corner. It's on the sound just up from the ferry landing. The storm took out their sign, but you can't miss the place if you know what to look for. Cute little eye-style house with yellow siding. It was built around the turn of the century by a Dr. Parnell, but it's a shop now, of course. Blue Adirondack chairs out front and a wraparound deck with ice cream tables. I'm not sure they're officially back open yet. It's been a nightmare around here, dealing with insurance claims, FEMA paperwork, and then, well, just try to find someone to do construction work who's not booked 6 months solid. And if you can get all that done, you've got all the inspections to deal with for your occupancy permit and whatnot. She shook her head, sighing and looking out the window. Sorry, I guess that's more than you needed to know. Are you visiting the island?
Just move here, I said, shifting toward the doorstep. How far is the shop? Can I walk? The SUV was on empty, and I had $5 in my pocket.
It's around a mile. You could walk it, but you might want to drive.
She smiled pleasantly and finished wiping the door. I thanked her and made my way out, then debated the gasoline issue for a minute before finally deciding to drive. I'd be running on fumes by the time I made it back home, but there was work to do at Iola's house, and aside from that, I wanted to find some time for the prayer boxes today. But first, I had one last errand to do. A little hummingbird mission of mercy. Today's good deed. The idea of it lifted my sense of impending doom as I drove past the shops and weathered houses of Hatteras Village. It's hard to feel bad about your own life when you're helping out someone else. Iola would like this one, too, I had a feeling. I felt like she was right there in the car with me, watching the sound through the bright, silvery eyes the UPS driver had described. She was smiling, her gnarled hands folded in her lap, resting against the blue-flowered dress. Paul's letter would probably be waiting when I got home. I could get that glass box off the top shelf and see what she had hidden inside. The UPS driver would be stopping by on his route also. I'd called and told him I had a surprise for him, from Iola. Sandy's seashell shop melted into view as I rounded the corner. It was just as the librarian had described, yellow lap siding, a front porch with blue Adirondack chairs. A wraparound deck where ice cream tables and twisted wire chairs waited in the shade of live oaks that looked scrappy after the last two storms. The tables and chairs were lying on their sides, as if a sudden wave had swept from the placid waters of Pamlico Sound and toppled all the furniture. As I climbed the steps, a black-and-white Boston Bulldog wearing a bandana and doggy swim trunks yipped at me and dashed through the open front door. I followed, stepping on the welcome mat to let my eyes adjust. Inside, the place was definitely in a state of construction. Store fixtures and shabby chic tables sat stacked against the wall by the door. Two overstuffed sofas and a mismatched collection of lamps had been pushed together with display cases in the center of the room, and bamboo stools sat legs up atop a rough-hewn wooden bar on the left side of the room. Overhead, a chalkboard advertised coffee and free Wi-Fi. Other signs here and there offered wisdom such as, "Life is better in flip-flops. Wake up and live." You can shake the sand from your clothes, but not from your soul. If your ship doesn't come in, swim out to it. Sandy feet always welcome. May you always have a shell in your pocket and sand in your shoes. And my favorite of all, sandcastles or seashells? That is the question. The wall opposite the bar had a hole in it where someone had torn down the sheetrock and exposed the studs. Pieces of wallboard lay on the floor, the mildewed lines of water damage drawing a landscape of mountains in black and brown. It looked sadly familiar. I'd driven my father to many a construction job involving flood damage and repair. Usually, people didn't know they had a lingering problem until mildew started coming through the sheetrock months later. Hello? I craned first to one side and then the other, searching for anyone working in the adjoining rooms. They were darker than this one, no lights on and the blinds drawn. A set of double doors hung open along the back wall, offering a view of the rear deck and the wall.